I really come to real estate not so much from a real estate perspective of I want to own X amount of doors, I want to own X amount of square feet. It's more I want to build a strong financial plan for myself and for others. Real estate is just part of that.
Do you love your job but want other investment options than your company's 401k and trying to pick stocks? If so, you've come to the right place. In this podcast, you will get actionable information for your passive real estate investment journey. Welcome back to another episode of Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast. Here's your host, Justin Dixon.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast. I'm your host, Justin Dixon. And today we've got Dovid Perel on the podcast coming to us from just outside of Jerusalem in Israel. He grew up in New Jersey and went to school in New York, but currently lives in Jerusalem. And so we talked a lot about his investing journey, starting out trading the stock market and options before having some losses, and then had decided to go back to work and then got into real estate investing, invest across multifamily, retail, office, mobile home parks, RV campgrounds. And so we talk about kind of the differences, and we also dig into RV campgrounds a little bit because he operates and owns two of them, one in Kentucky and one in Ohio. Very interesting conversation just about kind of the mindset of an investor. We talk a lot about how he vets operators. Obviously, he's investing out of country, and so he's got to find operators here in the US. So we go through a couple of questions that he asks them to make sure that he knows, likes, and trusts them enough to put his and his investors' money with them. So very interesting conversation. So let's get Dovid on the call. All right, Dovid, man, thank you for being on the podcast. Happy to have you on.
All right, pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Awesome. Well, let's kick things off. Give everybody a little bit of an overview of kind of who you are, where you are, and what you're up to.
All right. So again, Dovid Perel. I am based 15 minutes north of Jerusalem in Israel. And over the last 7 years, I've been helping people invest in really across a broad swath of real estate in the US, both geographically as well as by asset class. We've done multifamily, retail, office, industrial, mobile home parks, self-storage, and RV campgrounds. And our deals start up in Vermont, go down to Texas, and hit up a lot of the states in the middle. So the goal always was to help people build diversified portfolios. So to that end, we've partnered with a lot of good people. We've been using the last couple of years to kind of figure out who's really, really good and who's not. We're currently running our own two RV campground deals as well. And on top of that, again, in the spirit of diversification, I also have a hedge fund that I run.
So it seems like you've got a lot going on. So I want to kind of just like unpack a little bit about that. So I always like to know people's kind of origin story and how they get exposure to investing in general, but also real estate and I'll call it alternative assets, right? Because everybody is taught or explained that you invest in the stock market and the 401k, right? Those are kind of the things that as a normal human you get exposure to. So how did you get exposure to these other asset classes that are seemingly, to the untrained eye, only reserved for the rich and famous?
The alternative asset classes is such a mind control game, you know,
yeah.
Like make you feel nervous about it. It's like so scary. Gosh. So I grew up like a lot of people did. I grew up in New Jersey, went to school in New York, and I was exposed to a lot of the classic, you know, get a good job and you put your money away and you play it safe, quote unquote safe. And that's how you find success. And I looked around and I just saw a lot of the people who followed that plan and they were just working really hard. And they looked at the people who weren't doing that and they were all doing something else. They owned buildings, they were doing business, they weren't doing the traditional be a doctor, be a lawyer, be a dentist, whatever. So still remember the time it hit me. I was still in that point, I was essentially in the equivalent of graduate school. I was in a rabbinic training program. And I remember exactly when it hit me where, you know, we would say that phrase like you can have your money work for you, you can work for your money, you can have your money work for you. And
yeah,
I heard it before, but for some reason at that moment it just hit me like a ton of bricks, like the truth of that statement. And I didn't really do anything with it at the time. I wasn't in a mind frame of making money yet, but I really kind of got started in the world of investing in earnest. I had some money invested in some mutual funds, whatever, but I really got not serious about it, but I really started in 2009. I don't know if you remember January 2009. That was when the stock market was just like, whew.
Yeah.
I didn't really have much invested. Yeah, that was a rough time. But I remember thinking to myself, as someone who didn't really have a lot of money invested, who was sitting on some cash, this is probably a really good buying opportunity. So in January 2009, I started buying. The market had bottomed in March 2009. And for a while there, I was just making stupid money because, I mean, it was good returns, but it was stupid because I had no idea what I was doing. But just couldn't go wrong. The market was just in a rebound mode. I remember I bought Avis. I remember back when the rental car business was going to fail.
Right.
So Avis went down to like 39 cents a share. I bought it at 40 cents a share. Then I thought I was such a genius because I'm not going to be greedy like everyone else was unless I lost all their money. I didn't understand anything back then. I sold it at 65 cents a share. And then like a year later, is it 12 bucks a share? So I was making money, but I didn't know what I was doing. Eventually, I started learning how to trade options. And for a few years, I was making some good money. And then I made some mistakes, as is people like I was doing at that time or want to do. And I had some serious losses. So I kind of backtracked on that a little bit. I continued trading. I continued learning. Instead of backing out, I learned what I did wrong. And since then, I've built a very successful options portfolio that's been consistently profitable for several years now. There's an important principle there at play. There's this four stages of anybody who's going to be actively investing in the stock market, which is definitely worth noting. First stage is you're going to be making money and you're not going to know why. Second stage is you're going to lose money and you're not going to know why. That's when most people get out. Third stage is you lose money, but you know why. And then you make money and you know why. And that's when you can become successful. So you got to push through. And then that's an important lesson that I know a lot of people who started out trying to trade the stock market because everyone thinks they can do it because they're smart and they're successful. So they can trade the stock market and they get clobbered. Yeah. And none of them go beyond that point. And I know a lot of successful traders. I've seen them. I see it being done. So I'm like, it's got to be doable. I'm just as capable as the few people who do it. The difference is that these guys plugged away at it and figured it out.
Yeah.
So that was an important like kind of lesson for me that you can learn these things and you can figure these things out and there are ways to be successful. So anyway, so I was doing that.
That principle goes into just general life, right? Like we're in a interesting cycle within the multifamily real estate world, right? Where if you bought a deal in 2018, 19, you looked like a genius because you sold it in 2020 or 2021, doubled or tripled your returns in a few short years. And so to your point, you're making money, but you don't know why, right? The market is just going up and to the right. And then you bought something in 2021 or 2022, and then interest rates go up and now you're losing money and you don't know why, or you do because of interest rates and all of that. So I think we're kind of in this, like, we've lost money. We don't know why. Now we need to figure out, okay, how do we go and partner with the people that have gone through those cycles and kind of had hit those bumps in the road, but then have kind of kept going. So obviously you started in the market and I don't know anything about options trading. So I don't even want to dig into that because I'm sure it's a bigger conversation than 15, 20 minute podcast. But at what point did you start like getting into like real estate or anything like that? And obviously you were living in the US and now you're in Jerusalem. So I'm kind of curious how that transition worked and all of that.
Yeah. So once that portfolio, the first portfolio I was running kind of failed, I had to go ahead and get a job. And so I worked for a number of years in the real estate business here in Israel. Actually, I was a mortgage broker here in Israel. And in the course of doing that, I came across a lot of people who had some cash but couldn't afford to buy. Mortgages here are much tighter than the US. You have to come up with 30% down. You can't finance your closing costs. And income here, relative to the cost of housing, is certainly back then, and today's even worse, it's pitiful. So, I mean, I forget the numbers. The statistic already goes back several years, but back then it was like in the US to buy the average house, you needed like 2 years of average salary to buy your average house. And in Israel, it was like 12 years.
Oh,
so yeah, it was really hard to buy here and it's only gotten worse. So I would come across people who would have $50,000, $100,000, $200,000, and they just couldn't qualify for a mortgage. They couldn't buy anything. And they were just sitting on their cash. So again, I had been investing and my mentality, it all goes back to the mentality. I can't stress this enough that it's not so much about knowing what to invest in or finding the right people to buy. That's all important, obviously, the details. That's how you make your money. But one of my teachers once said, the details are what separates the men from the boys. Very important. But the mentality was always, there is opportunity here. There are ways to make money. And these people are kind of locked into not thinking they can do anything with their money.
Yeah.
So I set out at that time to help these people find opportunities to invest. I didn't want to do anything in the market yet. I was still going through my learning process and proving myself in that area. Not to mention, it's much more esoteric, as you said. One of the earliest lessons I learned when I started learning how to trade stocks was invest really in the stock market is you have to understand where your value is coming from. This is a very important principle in investing. You can't always come true. For example, if you invest in with like a hedge fund, it's going to be very hard for most people to understand the strategies there.
Yeah.
But and those create a challenge. I'm not going to deny that fact. But certainly one of the what's why I liked real estate is you have to know where your value is coming from. I mean, why did the 2009 crash happen? People were trading derivatives on derivatives of mortgage products. You lost track of who the underlying borrower was and you didn't realize it was all subprime, people lost track of where the value is coming from, and therefore the valuations lost touch with reality. What I like about real estate is, I mean, you've got to be good to operate a deal. Not anybody can operate a deal. There are a lot of details in a deal and you got to really be on top of it, and it's complicated. But at the end of the day, you own either a piece of land or a building and you collect rent, and the rent determines the value of the building. It determines how much cash you get out of the building every month, quarter, whatever it may be.
Yeah.
It's a very simple business model to understand, which is why if you're going to follow that rule of understanding where your money's coming from, real estate's a very appropriate investment for a lot of people. It's a very accessible investment.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where, and I will lump myself into this when you come talk about mindset, is because everybody, it's the norm to invest in the stock market, right? It's like everybody does it. It's like what you see on TV. Like you don't see people talking about real estate a lot on like CNBC. Like Squawk Box doesn't have like, they have like little clips of real estate as a broader economic measure, but not like, hey, these deals are doing X, Y, and Z like they do when it comes to like a company like Google or Tesla or anything like that. But like when you think about mindset, it's like giving somebody $50,000 and giving it to a person or a company to run a real estate deal is a lot different than putting $500 in your Robinhood account and buying a couple shares of Tesla or a share of Tesla or whatever it's at now. So how do you like talk to people about like the people that you knew that had $100,000-$300,000 in cash to think about investing in something maybe not in their backyard, because obviously they're in Israel and they're trying to buy their own primary residence, but say, okay, well, you may need to rent, but then you can purchase or invest in real estate, but it's in the US. Is that kind of what you started to kind of shift into and trying to help coach these people to think outside the box, so to speak, to from an investing standpoint?
Yeah, so getting these people to invest, or I should say, a lot of my investors, even the ones who are in Israel, are Anglos, specifically Americans. I have very few non-American investors, exactly for that reason. A lot of people need to feel comfortable, and a lot of Israelis just don't feel comfortable investing somewhere so far away they're not familiar with.
Yeah.
Not to say there isn't money from Israel going into the U.S. There's a ton of money from Israel pouring into the U.S. Unfortunately, the reality is a lot of those people lost money because they got burned because people were running bad deals, like really bad deals.
Got it.
I would even say criminal deals.
Yeah.
So you tell people you can buy a house in Philadelphia for $40,000 and make 20% cash on cash because you can throw it up in a spreadsheet. I think that's criminal. So there was that going on here for a while.
Yeah.
I'm sure that all stuff is still going on here because the rules around accredited investors and checking for things like that are a little different here. So you can do that. Not quite as much. And people have been caught by the securities authority. But anyway, that's a bit afar. But yeah, in terms of the basics of it, a lot of the people I speak to, they're already kind of warm to real estate investing. They kind of understand that something that people do. They come from within the Jewish community. And within that community, there is a lot, or it is actually a pretty active community in terms of real estate investing. So it's not as far a leap for a lot of people. But I have had people, I do speak to people who, for most people, I don't think I've ever had to either sell or convince anybody who's not interested in real estate. It was more people who were outside of it, but they'd seen, they had people they know who did it, they have friends who did it, and they just needed to understand it and become comfortable with it.
Yeah.
So I can't say I've helped anyone bridge a gap from like being super gung-ho about their 401k and convince them to put the money into real estate.
Got it. I want to kind of just dig into kind of the U.S. investing in Israel, because there's a lot of books around long distance investor or out of state investor. And obviously, that's typically talking about somebody that lives in Pennsylvania that's investing in Texas or something like that. It's much different, obviously, investing overseas and in different countries and all that. But before we jump into that, I want to take a quick sponsor break. So we'll be right back.
Whether you're in a job you love or hate, building a financial foundation is important. This foundation can support you by providing passive income, stability in an uncertain economy, or the launching pad for you to start your own business. Great Venture Capital helps busy professionals invest in commercial real estate to build passive income streams, grow wealth, and take advantage of tax benefits. If you'd like to learn more, check us out at greatventurecapital.com or send an email to justin@greatventurecapital.com.
All right, we are back on the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast. We've got Dovid on and we're talking about kind of long distance investing, a lot longer than out of state investing. One thing I wanted to kind of understand a little bit is how do you, like, obviously you're talking about the Jewish community is a very investment and real estate investment centric community. It's not foreign. There's a lot of people in the community doing it. And so it's just more normal than maybe other communities. And so getting people to be open to the investing idea maybe wasn't the challenge, but how do you vet sponsors or people that are finding deals in the US to make sure that you all feel comfortable investing with them? Because I think we're recording this in February of 24. We talked already about like the turmoil that's going on in the multifamily real estate space. So one of the things that I'm really conscious of now where when I'm thinking about where to put my money moving forward is making sure that I know as much as I possibly can about the person that found the deal, that brought me the deal, because finding a good sponsor, a good operator is very important to the success of the outcome of that deal. So long-winded answer of like, how do you kind of find those people and bring that information to your investors?
That is the million-dollar question. It's all about betting on the jockey, not the horse. Who you're working with is by far more important than any deal you're going to be doing. So for a while, I had a partner. For a number of years, I had a partner who had some experience in the field, and he went through this process with them. We've since parted ways. But right now, I'm not actually actively looking for new partners. I'm just kind of riding out the deals we're in and watching. I'm watching people out there. I'm watching who's closing deals right now and with a very skeptical eye. Most people I know who are, I'm not saying everyone closing now is bad, but I still remember, must have been a month into COVID, like April time, but like 2020.
Yeah.
And one of these crowdfunding groups sent out an email pushing a deal. And I'm like, my God, are they nuts? Like, how are they doing this now? No one knows what's going to be in 3 months from now. I was so turned off by that. So I'm being very cautious, but I'm also watching how people react to the current situation. So I have a decent sized pool of sponsors that I'm currently invested with. And the ones who are highly transparent, highly communicative, as well as responsible in how they handle the deals, those are the ones who I'm going to be working with again. The ones that are, if I send you a very straightforward question and I get back a 750-word essay, which doesn't even answer the question, I understand by the time I asked you the question the third time, I got an answer for you, but that's not what I want to be doing. I can't take my own money and certainly not my investors' money if I can't get straight answers from you. So again, what do we vet on? What I do for my investors is we have an 80 or 90 questionnaire that we go through with operators, and we rank people based on that. And we look at past deals and we talk to people. And based on that, we've been very careful about who we've gone in with. And also, I made a strategic decision in 2021 that we were going to only be doing cash flowing deals, deals that had solid cash flow, or we're going to very quickly be getting to solid cash flow, because I didn't want to be sitting on a lot of deals in the middle of a flip. Now, did that perfectly inoculate us? No, we had some deals that went through challenges. We have one deal that I don't want to comment on it here, but it's not the right forum for it. But the deal is stable, but we're getting very low distributions out of it because the refi got dragged on, whoever's fault that was. And instead of refinancing at 4.25%, we refinanced at 6.3%. So we got burned on our cash flow. We had another deal that going into the crunch, we had two deals that had to refinance. And one of them ended up refinancing and we had to do a capital call to pay down some of the debt. But since it was a painful experience, but the deal was stabilized, all the money went into paying down debt. So it went into equity. It wasn't a reef turnaround play. And since then, the deal has been operating very smoothly, paying out distributions. And it's in a good area. It's in Texas. And I'm happy to own in that market. The other deal we're in, we're still working off a rate cap. So we'll see where that goes. We have some more time on that. And hopefully we don't have to make a hard decision. I would say we have one deal exposed to this situation right now out of over 20.
That's a good ratio.
Which is not a bad place. Yeah, it's not a bad place to be portfolio-wise. We still have about half our deals are paying out. We have a couple deals. We have one deal that's refinancing now. And hopefully we're going to exit, but the market's not right. So we can refinance that when we got our rents up that we bought 4 or 5 years ago.
Okay.
So again, what do we do for our investors? We ask all those questions. And I can't say we've always done this. We were supposed to do this. I think we failed on delivery, but the idea was that through the questions that we asked along with the answers and some sort of long form questionnaire that our investors could read and understand more about the operators.
What are some of the key questions that are in that 80-90 question thing that you think are better indicators than others to having that operator be ranked higher? Because obviously there's probably some very tactical nitty gritty questions in there, but like, what are some of the ones that kind of get to like, okay, if they answer this a certain way, this is a high probability that it's a yes or a high probability that it's a no, depending on how they answer.
One question, which is how much debt do you take on? Nowadays, people are much more careful with that. But I once had one person tell me that the answer was as much as I can get. And that was an instant next. So there was that. We ask about, it's very important to know it's not just how many years of experience. People just kind of like, oh, they have 15 years of experience. But I want to know what those years of experience are in. Mm. I want to know what you've been doing in those 15 years. Because not all experience is transferable. If you've been doing multifamily property management for 10 years, and then a couple of years ago you switched over into retail management, and now you want to do single family fix and flips, mm-hmm. you have no relevant experience.
Right. Yeah.
So I want to make sure you have relevant experience and long enough relevant experience. And that's a very important thing we looked at. Another very important item that we look at is we look at reports. We would go back, we'd ask operators we asked them for OMs of deals that were 2, 3, 4 years old. Then we'd ask them for all their quarterly reports on that. So we can see, you know, this is what you promised. This is how the deal is doing. This is how you communicate with your investors. You want to see good communication. So we can see how they communicate with their investors. You know, not all of them are the most professional looking. I still remember one I got. It was very non-professional looking, but it had a ton of information. Every quarter they sent, every 1 month or quarter, I don't remember what it was, but they sent pictures of the property. They were clearly on the ground. They were working it. So that goes a long way. That's important.
I think it's super interesting because a lot of times you ask people about their track record and they talk about deals, but if you actually ask them for an OM that is arguably sent out to a lot of people that ask, or when you're looking at deals, you kind of have to get the OM and everything. And then to ask them to send you their quarterly or monthly, however they send reports to investors, because then you can obviously see, you can underwrite the deal yourself using kind of previous data, right? So you can see how aggressive they were or conservative they were, and then obviously what their success rate was. That's super fascinating. I've never thought about doing that, almost reverse engineering the deal kind of thing. That's interesting. I'm going to take that away and I'm going to steal that and use it. Yeah, I think it's super important, especially, I guess, that's helpful for somebody that is knowledgeable enough about multifamily and has underwritten deals, right? But also, I think the communication is a massive piece, right? I think a lot of the deals that I'm in, I would argue all the deals that I'm in, I wish communication was better and more consistent. I would say all of it, except for one. One deal that I'm in, the operator is very good. He's an engineer and a project manager by profession. So he is very buttoned up. And I've been on general partner on that deal. So I've been on asset management calls and he is very diligent on what is going on with the property, what is going on with every unit, and making sure that we are squeezing as much juice out of the deal, especially right now, as we possibly can. But I would say a large portion of all the deals that I'm in, as well as deals that I think many of my friends are in, communication could be better. And it leads me to my next point around asset management being kind of one of the most important roles in a deal, especially once it's closed, right? Because obviously, to your point earlier, you can make anything look great on a spreadsheet. But reality, once you close that deal, the asset manager is the one who is making sure that the on-site property management team is doing the things they need to be doing to execute on the business plan, right? So you're obviously invested across multiple asset classes, which I'm very interested in kind of touching on for a second here. But like, how do you think about when you're looking at operators, how heavily do you weight the asset manager and making sure that they are the type of asset manager that you want?
I think it all goes together with the GP, is we're looking at the operator as a whole in terms of how they report and everything else. So I think part of that is we see what comes out of there in those reports is what kind of clarity are we getting. One thing we look for early on is, and this will do, we're constantly vetting, is whenever we're asking questions, we're always looking as how clear and how straightforward an answer are we getting. That's very important to us. And to me, if we're dealing with somebody who can give straightforward, clear answers, with every question we're asking, again, we're asking sophisticated questions. We're diving deep into the numbers. And I hardly ever get an OM that I don't catch a mistake in the math. I usually catch a mistake in the math. And I don't blame them for that. I get it. They're dealing with huge data sets and things can creep in. And okay. But I want to see how it's dealt with. Usually it's not a material difference, obviously. But
yeah,
I want to see how they react to that. Sometimes they have good answers. Sometimes it makes sense. But how they react when they're challenged, I think, is a very strong indicator in many situations of the character of the person, as well as their handle on the actual information, which, as again, as an asset manager, that's what I want. I want somebody who knows what's going on and they kind of have that big picture view of the entire investment, as well as understanding how the pieces fit together.
Got it. No, it makes sense. So we've obviously dug into multifamily, and that's really my area of kind of, I wouldn't say expertise, but area of interest, at least over the last few years. I've started to dip into or talk to people more about mobile home parks. That was kind of the flavor of the month a number of years ago when Brandon Turner came out and was like buying all these mobile home parks and all that stuff on Bigger Pockets. I've had actually a guy on my podcast who's done RV campgrounds. So
that's what I did. I got two of those.
How did you get into the different asset classes? Because it's hard enough to be good and know the necessary information about one asset class. And obviously it's all commercial real estate, but like, how do you figure out dipping into these? Like, do you have specific operating partners that are experts in those areas and you partner with them, and or how does that all work?
So for most asset classes, we're not the GP. For most asset classes, we find the operating partners, we work closely with them, and as we've grown and we bring larger checks, we're able to co-GP in significant ways. There are many deals we brought the entire check and we have regular calls with them, and that's very helpful in terms of really getting to know them well and building confidence. And some of those people are the people who I will do business with for years to come.
Yeah.
And that was all built on the premise that I really come to real estate, not so much from a real estate perspective of I want to own X amount of doors, I want to own X amount of square feet. It's more, I want to build a strong financial plan for myself and for others. Yeah. And real estate is just part of that. It's a good place to be invested. Doesn't mean it's the only place I want to be invested. So to that end, I wanted to be diversified, and it paid off because multifamily is taking a hit right now, but we have other assets that are doing okay. Office is taking a hit, but we actually focused during COVID, we actually focused on suburban office, which has done relatively okay relative to office. Class A suburban office has done pretty well. We have one Class A suburban office building we're in the middle of converting to industrial because it was just, oh man, that building was so good and it got clobbered. And so we closed on that building in October of 2019. We had no idea it was coming. It was a 300,000 square foot building, Class A, beautiful building in New Jersey. The top floor was empty. We had to fill 100,000 square feet, which should not have been a challenge. COVID hit, boom, boom, boom. Now all of a sudden, everyone's taking smaller office space. We can't subdivide the top floor into anything less than 25,000 square feet units. So we're in the middle of converting it to industrial. I was talking to one of my investors about it. We were going over it, and he's a real estate guy. His family's a real estate family. He's a real estate guy. And he's looking at it, he's like, it's such a nice building. It's so unfortunate that we're going to tear it down. And I'm like, I never thought of it that way, but you're right. It is a really nice building. But then we got to the RV space. So we did our thing. We were looking, vetting operators, finding people, talking to people. Oh, another, by the way, another is an important thing. Another thing we did was we spoke to people in the industry about who's closing and who's doing good work. So we were able to find out from realtors, from mortgage brokers, from people out there to kind of also get recommendations that way. When we got to the RV space, the RV campground space, just to be clear, we're not talking about RV parks, we're talking about RV campgrounds.
Got it. What is the difference?
Well, a campground is where you vacation, an RV park is where you live.
Got it. Okay.
So that got me excited because I'm not a real estate guy. I'm an opportunity guy. I'm an entrepreneur. I want to see new things. I'm building a business. And the RV campground space got me very excited because it struck me as a very interesting business opportunity, a very interesting arbitrage opportunity. It hadn't gone through the same type of institutionalization like the multifamily or commercial space had gone through. There's still a ton of mom and pop operators out there.
Yep.
And there's a lot of opportunity in the space to do some interesting things. And not to mention that there's that whole business side of it. But multifamily, how much money can you get out of a building already? What can you put in there? With RV campgrounds, you're catching people on vacation. So as long as you can provide them with a better vacation, they're happy to pay money to have a better experience. You can always take it further. So that's a space that I decided I wanted to go into deeper. And I went to some shows. We met a number of people. We took another local US partner. And we bought two parks with two partners. And since then, we've gotten more actively involved in the management side of those parks. Mm. And it's been a very interesting learning experience.
When did you buy them and where are they?
So we have one park in Kentucky.
Okay.
And that park we closed on in April of 2022.
Okay.
And we have another park in Ohio, and that we closed on in August, September of 2022. Very different parks. Very different parks. The one in Kentucky has 68 seasonal campsites, but it also has a hotel, which generates about half the revenue. And we're trying to get that up and make it 2/3 of the revenue. And it also has a house that used to be owned by the managers or the owners and managers. And now we're working on, we already made it into an Airbnb. Now we're working on enhancing the Airbnb there. Not to mention that we also have an area there that we're converting into a restaurant. So you see all of a sudden there are all these different pieces of revenue that aren't even RV related necessarily. Right. The campground in Ohio is 250, we'll call it, sites. Traditionally, it's been mostly seasonal, which means people pay for the whole season. They come for 6 to 8 months. And then with a smaller number of transient sites, that campground has been through a challenge over a number of years. It went through prior to us and our partner's purchase, the previous owners, they made it into a party park and it was not a good experience there. We took it over and we've been working hard to bring back that family vibe in the park. And our goal for this year is we've kind of stabilized the management team in place and we've got the campers back in a place feeling like the park is clean, it's nice, it's good. And we're hoping for a really good 2024. But there's been turnaround. We've had to put a lot more work into these parks than we realized. Learned a lot of lessons, met a lot of good people. And we'll see what happens if we decide to buy more of these. But that park has different potential. It's on the river. There's traffic that comes down the river, potentially to solve it there. We can have events there. There's a wide open field. There's a lot of interesting. It's a different park, different clientele, different opportunity to monetize.
Got it. Yeah, I mean, it sounds like almost like a value add strategy with some of these where you're not just going in and cleaning it up. You're going in and actually looking for other revenue opportunities and revenue streams. And the one in Ohio, you're trying to change the tenant profile, right? Which is a lot of what you're trying to do in some of these multifamily spaces, especially trying to go from like a C air or C property to a B or B plus.
Maybe I misrepresented. We're not looking to change the tenant profile. I think we're trying to just cut out a small number of the tenants who aren't fitting that profile and then remarket to the tenants who had been there in the past and get occupancy back up. One of the key factors I learned in this space is that I never wanted to go into the hotel space because I always knew hotel is more of a business than it is a real estate play.
Yeah.
And what I've learned in the RV space is also really more of a business, maybe even more of a business than a hotel, than a real estate play.
Okay.
So that's kind of the question mark is, how do you do that? And if you build an RV campground management business, you're only half in real estate, which is not a bad thing, but it is a reality because there is a business component there, which leads to interesting questions about SBA financing, et cetera. But the cost egg is awesome, by the way, on those properties.
Oh, really?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, we got one of those parks. We got like 96%.
Well, that's when Jonas got involved, right?
Jonas said that was the highest he's ever seen.
Yeah, that's how you and I met. So it's all coming full circle.
Yep.
So let's kind of like flash forward or look into the future a little bit. As I mentioned, it's February 2024. You're obviously looking at a lot of different asset classes in commercial real estate. You're obviously looking at other investing opportunities as well outside of just real estate. But what are you communicating to your investors as far as like your thoughts for 24? Do you have an asset class that is maybe your favorite that you're really kind of like actively looking at opportunities in, even more so than just kind of keeping an eye on things? But I'm just kind of curious about your thoughts or outlook for 24.
Yeah, my starting point in all of my investing is I don't know the future. That kind of differentiates me from a lot of people. I don't know when rates are going to go down. I know what my gut tells me, but I still remember when rates started going up and people thought they were going to come down a few months later and people were like, oh, look, here's the yield curve. And you can see by like January 2024, rates are going to be here. And I'm like, the yield curve doesn't mean anything. Like, that's just what the markets are predicting, but we don't know what it's going to be. And sure enough, those yield curves are now like this.
Yeah.
So it's a very tricky market right now. I don't profess to have any edge in terms of knowing what's right, what's wrong. I have the markets that I operate in right now. I think my guess is my first real estate deal going forward will probably be something in the Vermont area. We've been buying up properties there with one. We have a very close partner up in that area. We bought our first portfolio there back in mid-2022.
What kind of asset class? Multifamily or?
Small multifamily. Vermont's a very interesting, unique market, kind of separate from everything else. There's nothing big there. I think the biggest property I've seen is 15 units.
Oh, wow.
You can't really build big over there. And what that does is institutional investors have no interest there. So the market kind of exists in its own little bubble.
Huh.
It's really cool, Vermont. I was on my trips in the U.S. I was in, Atlanta? I was in Atlanta, Georgia one day. The next day I was in Vermont and going to a supermarket in Vermont. And the same thing that in Georgia, in Atlanta cost like $2 and Vermont was like 89 cents. You get a cup of coffee there for like $1 or something, $1.50. It was really interesting. The market, the whole place there, it was like the land that time forgot. It was crazy.
And I've never been to Vermont, even though I grew up in the Northeast.
Oh, it's beautiful. I mean, the reason why it's beautiful is the reason why real estate's terrible there is because basically anybody can stop you from building for any stupid reason. What that does is it creates, when you have more of those arbitrage opportunities where, again, it hasn't been a lot of sophisticated operators in the area. Our partner's been active there for 10 years. Mm-hmm. Again, it's a little more work. The deals are going to be smaller, but there is opportunity and they cash flow nicely once you get them up and running, which we've been able to do. Labor is a challenge. Labor is a challenge everywhere.
Yeah.
But our portfolio's there. We've been able to stabilize them usually in a year or less. And once they're stabilized, they cash flow amazingly. We haven't any exits yet. We were looking at some exits, but the market turned against us and we're not able to exit, but we're cash flowing just fine. And we just had a call a couple of days ago and I told him, like, he's like thinking, do we exit? Do we refi? I said, look, I don't need to exit. I'm perfectly happy sitting here cash flowing at 15% a year. Like, I have no need to exit. And my investors will be very happy just collecting those checks every quarter. Like, so he's like, okay, we'll do that. So we have right now, the fees are a little high. Look, we have to charge higher fees over there just because if we charge the standard, the deals are so small sometimes. We're buying portfolios of, like, we bought one building, 15 units. The whole thing was like $1 million, maybe less. Yeah. It's like $600,000. It was very small, but they're intensive to run because they're serious renovation value add. I want to say serious. It's not gut renovations. Usually it's $8,000 to $10,000 job per unit.
Yeah.
But it's still, there's a lot of management on the ground and you don't lose the economy of scales, but there's a lot of value there. So that's
also
a market
that...
If you
start to get a few of them in a certain area, then you can accomplish the economies of scale, right? You can operate it as a portfolio.
We do that. We're doing that. We buy in areas, but even then, you buy an apartment building in South Carolina or Houston, you're buying a couple hundred units.
Yeah.
Here... We bought a portfolio back in 2022. We raised $1.3 million. The total value is about $4 million. It was like 35 units spread across 8 different properties, each one financed separately.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
it's messy.
It's messy.
It's really messy. Look, there's a reason why the institutionalized markets are easy to operate in. The challenge is you're competing with bigger money.
Yeah.
And there's less inefficiency. The inefficiency creates opportunity, but you got to deal with the inefficiency. It's the same thing in the RV space. The inefficiency creates opportunity, but you got to deal with the inefficiency.
Makes sense.
But my guess is that'll be the first market I go back into. Right now, I'm very focused on my activities in the options markets. That's been something which has proven itself for several years now. And I'm in the middle of using this opportunity, kind of the lull in the real estate side, to enhance my education there, learn new things, and enhance hedging in the portfolio so that the portfolio is a lot more robust. So I'm just taking the opportunity to do better.
Yeah. No, I mean, you got to kind of strike while the iron's hot and go where, while there's a lull in one area, it's opportunity to learn about different things. So I totally get it. So Dovid, this has been an awesome conversation. I want to kind of transition to the final three questions that I ask every guest. So the first question is, what is one piece of advice that got you started or helped you along your investing journey? And you can think about it in real estate or just general investing.
So much to learn. There's an old, teaching from Jewish literature that says, who is a wise man who learns from everybody? There is so much to learn and there's so much opportunity out there. I can't pinpoint any one lesson that I would say, but I would just say, just learn from everybody. There's just so much opportunity. There's so many ways to make money. And there's so many ways to be successful in life. So just learn from everybody and learn from every opportunity you get.
Yeah, no, I like it. I mean, you never know where you're going to get new information from. It may be a very unlikely source and you got to just be open to it. Makes sense. What's your favorite real estate or business book that you're into right now?
So many good books out there. I'm not going to bore people with the book I'm reading about options trading right now. That's a 500-page, dense piece of writing. If you want to be a good passive investor, that's actually more about having a range of skills than being an expert in one particular area.
Yeah,
I was reading this great book. It's really interesting, well-written, called Range. I forget who wrote it. David something.
Just like, Range, R-I-N-G-E?
Let me look it up here. Yeah, Range by... David Epstein, Range by David Epstein. It's a green book with keys on the cover. Why Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World. It's given to me by a friend of mine. Literally a physical copy of the book given to me by a friend of mine.
Yeah.
And it's about generalized skill sets and about having a range of skill sets and being able to apply knowledge from one area to another. Very well written, very interesting book. And certainly in a day and age when everyone is being told the riches are in the niches, and you got to really specialize in something, it's A, encouraging for people who are by nature generalists. And it's also just kind of opens your mind a little bit to a different way of thinking about knowledge and how to be successful.
Got it. No, I like it. I consider myself a recruiting generalist. So from a recruiting standpoint, I like that thought process of being more generalist focused and applying knowledge from one area to another. I completely agree. All right, here we go. Final question is, if you hit your financial freedom number, meaning you're going to live an amazing life just off of the passive income from your investments, what would you do?
So that's an easy one. That's the one I've thought about already. So at that point, I would probably take off a year or two from all my active business activity, any marketing and sales related activity, and spend time on family and God. And after that, it would be a question of, and this I don't have an answer for myself yet, is at that point, do I continue on that track or do I apply myself in a different area? Because even in business, I found in my life probably one of the greatest growth experience, personal growth experiences I've had is being successful in business, because you have to really work on yourself and learn and be humbled and be wrong and be willing to grow with that. And also one question which I find myself asking myself a lot is, as I get closer and closer to those goals, is do I just stop? Or do I take that and apply it somewhere else? And I have things of value in both directions. I'm not just going to stop and find a beach and just relax all day. Not myself, but it would be a question of the more internal religious type of work, or do I apply it in a more external way? So that's a question which I plan on struggling with at some point in the future, but certainly immediately it would be to cut back on a lot of the external work and give myself more time to work on the internal work and then take it from there.
I like it. I definitely don't think I can see myself just sitting on a beach for the rest of my life, maybe for a month or two, just to kind of decompress. But yeah, I totally get it. This has been awesome. Really appreciate the time. If people want to learn more about what you're doing, if they want to maybe reach out because they live in Vermont and they have a multifamily property they want to sell you, like, how can people get in touch with you?
So I'm very active on LinkedIn, DOVIDPREIL. So that's a great way to reach me. Also my website, ydlpinvestments.com. And if you want to learn more about the general philosophy, there's the Think Wealthy podcast, which is available at thethinkwealthypodcast.com, as well as Apple, Google, etc.
Awesome. Very cool, man. This has been great. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. This has been fun.
Awesome.
I hope you got value out of this episode of the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast, your one-stop shop for education on how you can continue to work hard in your career and have different options to invest even harder. If you took anything away from this episode, please like and comment. I read every comment as it helps me serve you better. Make sure to subscribe and hit the notification bell. That way you won't miss out on more valuable content. If you're watching this video, it means that you want to grow your passive real estate portfolio. The easiest way to do that is to join our investor club by heading to greatventurecapital.com/invest. The link is in the show notes. See you on the next episode.